From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. WedTech was a little company in a depressed neighborhood that in just a few years grew into a multi-million dollar defense contractor. Quite a success story. Only later did the truth come out, the bribery, the fraud, and the theft. On this edition of Fresh Air, we look at the WedTech scandal with journalist James Traub, author of Too Good to Be True. Also today, we reconsider the legacy of guitarist Jimi Hendrix with British music critic Charles Shar Murray. And TV critic David Bianculli reviews American Chronicles. It's kind of an offbeat travelogue of the country from Mark Frost, the co-creator of Twin Peaks. That and more on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. NASA scrubbed the launch of the space shuttle Columbia today for the third time. The space agency says a fuel leak was discovered as liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen were being pumped into the shuttle's fuel tank. The decision to stop the launch was made after unacceptably high levels of hydrogen were found in the shuttle's aft compartment. A similar hydrogen leak grounded the shuttle in May. In the 3 months since the leak was discovered, NASA has tested and retested fuel lines on all three shuttles. Today, Secretary of State James Baker announced that the United States will open direct talks with the government of Cambodia. Baker told the Senate Foreign Relations Committee that the ranking American diplomat in Laos will represent the U.S. in the talks. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Secretary Baker called the opening of talks with Cambodian Prime Minister Hun Sen the next logical step in efforts to negotiate an end to Cambodia's long civil war. This step follows on last July's announcement that the U.S. would begin talks with Vietnam, which has backed the Hun Sen government in its fight against three guerrilla factions. With today's announcement, the U.S. has further eased its policy of isolating the Hun Sen government, which the U.S. viewed as illegitimate, having been installed by the Vietnamese. Today's move seems designed to bring the Hun Sen government along in diplomatic efforts to end the fighting. Last week, the UN Security Council approved a peace plan for Cambodia, backed by all the major powers. The Cambodian factions are to send representatives to Indonesia this week to discuss the UN plan. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Talks between native leaders and Canadian government officials took place this afternoon in an effort to get formal negotiations going between the government and the Mohawks at Oka, Quebec. Natives there have been surrounded by the army since Saturday. Richard Reynolds reports.
Currently, the Mohawks at Oka, about 20 armed warriors and about 40 women and children, are holed up in a drug treatment center, completely surrounded by the army. They have less than 1 acre of land still in their possession. The two sides have come face to face with weapons at the ready on several occasions in the past few days, and many Indian leaders fear that violence could start at any time, perhaps accidentally. Today's meeting was between the Federal Minister of Indian Affairs and Indian leaders. The meeting ended with both sides saying that talks may start soon, and both agreeing that something needed to be done to relieve some of the tension at Oka. But the Quebec government is the key player in this crisis. They control the army. And the Quebec government shows no signs of budging from its demand for unconditional surrender, something many of the warriors have vowed never to do. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds reporting.
Wall Street went into a moderate rally today that recovered most of the losses of the past week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 15 points to close at 2,628.22. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Things aren't always what they seem to be, and that was the case with the story of WedTech. It started as a small tool and die company in the South Bronx. With the help of the Small Business Administration's special set-aside program for minority-run businesses, the company grew in the early 80s to become a $100 million defense contractor. President Reagan described the company's co-founder, John Marriotta, as a hero for the 80s. But WedTech became one of the scandals of the Reagan era, with links to presidential aide Lynn Nofziger and Attorney General Edwin Meese. WedTech's success, it turned out, was the result of bribery, influence peddling, and fraud. The WedTech story is the subject of the new book, Too Good to Be True. My guest is the author, James Traub. He's written about crime, business, and politics for The New York Times, The New Republic, and Spy magazine. I asked Traub what he thinks the WedTech story is really about.
Well, it's about several things. To me, at the broadest level, it's about human nature. One of the things that I found fascinating about WedTech was that here was a group of people, the fellows who ran this company, who in effect went through the world asking for people to join them in their corrupt crusade. That is, they enlisted the help of politicians and of lawyers and of accountants and of government officials and of all sorts of people, very prestigious. And the remarkable thing is no one said no, or I should say scarcely anyone said no. In the perennial contest that WedTech created between the rules and self-interest, self-interest always won out, and it was a comment on the ingenuity of the company that they were always able to put things in such a way that they could get the help of others. At the political level, I think I actually am a little bit shocked that people were so indifferent to the rules. People were always willing to bend the rules. The Reagan administration helped WedTech in any number of ways, and I think in some ways violated its own professed belief in the free market by allowing WedTech to essentially trample on the rules of that marketplace.
WedTech got started through a loan from the Small Business Association. This was a set-aside program, a program for minorities. Was WedTech really minority-owned?
Well, that's one of its many, many frauds they committed. And I should add, by the way, that this program you've mentioned, which is called the 8A program, was created to help minorities get started in a relatively non-competitive atmosphere in minority businesses. It was always afflicted with fraud. There were all sorts of companies that not only weren't owned by minorities, they only had a front man, a fellow who simply signed his name. WedTech was not really owned more than 50% by a minority member, but I must say, in that regard, they were less flagrant than a lot of other violators of that program. They claimed to be owned two-thirds by a fellow of Hispanic origin named John Mariotta. In fact, Mariotta only owned half of the company, and they pretended to own two-thirds in order to get into the program.
Tell us a little bit about how WedTech got started and what WedTech was in its early days.
In its early days, WedTech was something wonderful. And it's odd for me to say that, given that people think of it only as this byword for corruption. But WedTech, not only in its early days, but always, was a company which had a strong kernel, a core of idealism and a kind of crusading quality. It began as a little machine shop in the South Bronx, and everyone knows, I guess, by now that the South Bronx is the sort of symbol for the blighted urban ghetto, and especially in the mid-60s when WedTech started up. It was a disaster area, and here was this remarkable little company, at that time making things like baby carriage equipment, in the midst of this awful slum. I visited it myself in 1978 when I was just a reporter, and I saw this remarkable little factory, machine shop in this awful area, and I was just struck by how wonderful it was. And I was one of the many reporters who wrote articles extolling the virtues of this firm. And so it remained for the first 5 or 10 years, run by this fellow John Mariotta, a very, very odd fellow, but wonderful mechanic, a man who really had genius in his hands as a tool and die man. Who was later joined by another rather odd fellow, a fellow named Fred Neuberger, who was a Holocaust escapee from Romania, later a terrorist or freedom fighter for Israel in its war for independence against the British. And these two fellows slowly built up the company its initial years and then got wind of this set-aside program that we've discussed, and all of a sudden through that program began to get very large government contracts aided by the political influence for which they later became infamous, and all of a sudden grew from this tiny little machine shop to a very large, at least by the standards of a place like the South Bronx, a very large defense contractor.
How did they get into the defense business?
Well, you know, the principal agency of government in terms of letting contracts is the Defense Department. So for most of the firms that join the set-aside program, their goal is to get some kind of contract with the Pentagon. Now, for the vast majority of those firms, the work they do are primarily in service industries. For example, food service. And I think a lot of minority businessmen feel that the racism of the military manifests itself in the form of giving them these not very advanced, not very sophisticated sort of contracts. WedTech was relatively unusual in that they did relatively complex metal fabrication work, and there were not a lot of competitive firms, even within the set-aside program, that could do the same kind of work they did. And such competition as there was, WedTech always managed to annihilate by means of their political influence. So after getting some multi-million dollar contracts, $3, $4, $5, $6, $7 million, in 1982, they managed, by basically steamrolling all opposition inside the uniformed army, to get a contract to build engines for fuel generators for the Army, which ultimately totaled almost $28 million, and that really sent them on their way.
My guess is James Traub and his new book, Too Good to Be True, is the story of WedTech. You've been referring to the political influence that that they used to help them grow and to help get Defense Department contracts. Where did that start?
Well, as in all things, WedTech started small and then built their way up with remarkable speed and ambition. It started when Mario Biaggi, who is now languishing in jail but was then a congressman from the Bronx, paid a visit to the company in 1978. Now, WedTech, though, in the Bronx, was not in his constituency. It was in the adjacent one. But Biaggi, at that time, also had a law firm going, as well as being a congressman, which was not, by the way, illegal then. It isn't now, though it would be harder to do. And Biaggi let them know that it would be in their interest to become clients of his law firm. And their response was, we don't need a lawyer. But they were smart enough to see that it wasn't exactly legal work that he had in mind. It was political representation. So they retained the Biaggi firm, and Biaggi and his then-partner, Bernard Ehrlich, essentially began helping WedTech at the local level with problems that they had in New York, and probably provided enough service to justify the amount that WedTech was paying them. From there, WedTech started to move into higher spheres of political influence. They also made payments, and payments that were later found to be corrupt, to the congressman who did represent them, Robert Garcia. Likewise, with the borough president of the Bronx, Stanley Simon. Both of those fellows were later convicted for receiving those money, though Garcia's conviction was overturned on appeal. From there, they went up to the national level. And they became sizable political contributors, essentially doing just the same thing that all of the big defense contractors do. WedTech was always intensely conscious of following along the lead they found in the world outside them. And they knew that the way you got contracts, if you were a McDonnell Douglas or a Grumman, was to give lots of money to the important congressional officials and also to hire as many former Pentagon bigwigs as you could. So WedTech focused in terms of its political contributions, and I should make it clear that there's nothing illegal per se about political contributions, on Alphonse D'Amato, who was, of course, a senator from New York and an influential person. And over the years, WedTech gave him at least $30,000 and perhaps more. And D'Amato always went to bat for the company and never questioned its bona fides and became a very important player. From there, WedTech moved up into the ultimate big leagues of the Reagan administration.
Yeah, well, people like Lynn Nofziger and Ed Meese were implicated in the WedTech scandal. What was Lynn Nofziger's role, and how did he get involved? And what was in it for him?
Money. Originally, what WedTech offered to Reagan officials was simply the political image, which, after all, is not an inconsiderable thing, of a company doing just what President Reagan said minority companies and minorities in general should do, which is pulling itself up by its bootstraps. The fact is, WedTech was doing no such thing. It was maneuvering the political system with tremendous ingenuity and cheating left and right. But it gave the impression of being a kind of a symbol for the success of the free enterprise system. So this was something that the administration could champion, and indeed that's what President Reagan had in mind when he referred to John Marriott as a hero for the 80s. So WedTech, when trying to get this engine contract that I've mentioned, went to the administration, had the clever idea of taking out an advertisement in which the company, and through a Latin American Manufacturing Association, a lobbying group, stood up and said that it favored the new Reagan administration economic plan in 1981. So they knew how to get on board and support the administration agenda. They appealed to Lynn Nofziger, who was then not only Reagan's very close friend, but his chief political operative, to help them get this contract. And Nofziger didn't do that much until the spring of 1982, when he quit government service and became, as so many important government officials do, became a lobbyist, essentially lobbying his own former colleagues in government. One of his first clients was WedTech, though it was actually disguised. The client was this Hispanic lobbying organization, but it really was WedTech. And Nofziger then went to his old friend, Ed Meese, also President Reagan's old friend, and said, Ed, it would be a big political blunder if we don't give this contract to WedTech. The symbolism is very important. And Meese didn't do very much. All he did was he went to some of his associates, his aides, he then being the White House counselor, and said something to the effect of, keep an eye on these fellows, let's make sure the process doesn't go awry. Well, when you're Ed Meese, that's not very much different from saying, let's make sure these guys get their contract. And by the spring of 1982, Mises' chief aide, a fellow named Jim Jenkins, had basically called all the military officials together who were resisting WEDTEC and basically said, cut it out, fellas, give these guys the contract. And at that point, the Army said, well, we've got our marching orders, we did our best to resist, we don't think this company should build the engines, but we'll give them the contract. And they did, and that pattern repeated itself several times over in terms of pressure from the Reagan administration.
You were talking about how the Reagan administration liked the sound of this company because it seemed to represent the kind of free enterprise that the Reagan administration was behind. Now, you also say that you think that Republicans saw Hispanics more than blacks as natural Republicans.
Yes.
Explain that.
Well, this was explained to me by a very learned political official, Ed Rollins.
Let me interrupt here.
Yes.
That the reason why I'm bringing this up is because John Mariotto, who was one of the founders of WEDTEC, is Hispanic.
Yes, that's right. He was Hispanic, and the company was set aside program because it was run by a Hispanic. And Ed Rollins, who came to replace Lynn Nofziger when he left as the chief political operative, explained to me when I came to talk to him that the Republicans had decided that Hispanics being culturally more conservative, I think this was the phrase they used, had a natural sense of affinity with the Republican Party that perhaps blacks did not. Blacks having a sense of grievance, which led them to favor more government, whereas Hispanics might actually have a more libertarian point of view. And I believe that to some extent, voting patterns bear that out, though not nearly as much as Republicans have hoped. So this set-aside program has always had a political function. In the Nixon days, its function was to create the black middle class, which President Nixon always spoke about. In the Reagan administration, even though the Reaganites, of course, believed in free enterprise and therefore presumably would not believe in the kind of affirmative action program that the set-aside program really was, never called for its abolition, or at least not until quite late in the game, and tried to use it to bolster their standing amongst Hispanics, and in fact replaced many blacks in the ranks of the program with Hispanic officials.
Let's take a break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is James Traub, and his new book is called Too Good to Be True. It's the story of the corruption of the WEDTEC Corporation in the South Bronx. Traub writes for The New York Times, The New Republic, Harper's, and Spy Magazine. This is Fresh Air. My guest is James Traub. We're talking about the WEDTEC Corporation, and that's the subject of his new book, Too Good to Be True. You were talking about the way the Reagan administration used WEDTEC as exemplifying some of the administration's own business goals and orientation. How did WEDTEC fit into the Reagan administration's plans for enterprise zones?
Well, there's a wonderful story that, in fact, I start my book off with. In which John Mariotto, who, again, was the chairman of the company and was almost illiterate and oddly enough, really didn't speak either English or Spanish very well. I can vouch for his English, and I've been told that his Spanish wasn't all that terrific, who really was a strange, trapped, in some ways quite brilliant and also paranoid fellow, was invited to the White House in order to be present at a symposium that was being held as a kind of pep rally for the Enterprise Zone. You'll remember that the Urban Enterprise Zone was the Reagan administration's one and only effort to do something about the problems of inner-city poverty. So Mariotta, as an exemplar of the idea of free enterprise in the ghetto and of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, was invited to be at the symposium. And the poor fellow was, I think, genuinely terrified. He'd never been in the White House. He didn't really know prominent people like that. And he sat in this meeting, of which there's a wonderful photograph, the chandeliers glittering on the table. He sat there fiddling and feeling terrified, but he's also an evangelical personality. He's a person with a fanatical belief in himself. He always had this belief even after all of his crimes were revealed. And finally, he burst out and began speaking. And he then delivered a monologue of maybe 20 minutes in which he implored the president, who was sitting there, to get the opium of welfare off the taxpayers' backs by emulating the example of WEDTEC. And he spoke on and on about WEDTEC, and a number of the people I've spoken to said they thought this was a charming person, but about halfway to being a nutcase. And there's a photograph of this event where you can see various luminaries like Treasury Secretary Donald Regan or the Congressman Barbara Conable, looking in boredom and perplexity at this fellow. And there is Ronald Reagan, rapt. John Mariotta is leaning forward, expostulating. President Reagan is leaning forward. The light has fallen onto his face. He's gazing at John Mariotta. And to me, this represents the transmission of a fantasy from one dreamer to another. I think both Mariotta and Reagan were people who lived more in the realm of magic than the realm of reason. And I think President Reagan had a kind of instant affinity for not only John Mariotta, but a lot of other people like him, people who told wonderful stories of delightful things that just ought to be true. And in these people's mouths, it was true. And President Reagan could then believe that it was true and recite back to the American people the stories he'd been told, as he did when he spoke of John Mariotta as a hero for the 80s. So Mariotta not only proved to Reagan's mind, I suppose, that these ideas were true, he was a physical narrative embodiment of the idea of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps and eschewing welfare.
Do you see WETEC as a company that started off honest and then through learning how to play the game got corrupt?
Yeah, I think that these fellows did not originally plan on doing anything corrupt. They simply wouldn't let the company die and they wouldn't let anything stand in its way. They were all originally fueled by the hopes of doing something grand. And indeed, I went to see this company, and if anybody else went to see it, and many did, they were stunned by the vision of a gleaming factory floor with the most modern computer-controlled equipment turning out quite sophisticated machinery in the midst of this devastated environment of the South Bronx, with rotting cars sitting on the corner and winos and just that overall air of helplessness. Here was something fabulous. Here was a dream, and it was real. And to some extent, it was always real. What happened was, first, they committed crimes to prevent the company from going out of business. Once they had done that, they committed crimes to increase its prospects, to get new contracts. And once they had done that, they committed crimes to simply out of greed, just to get money. Once they had started on it, there was never any turning back. And I think their sensibilities got hardened very quickly.
How did they learn the ropes? How did they learn which crimes to commit to keep solvent?
They had a lot of help. An interesting moment came in 1983 when the company had decided to go public. They finally, when you go public, you have to open up your books to the world, auditors, lawyers, bankers, and so on, as well as potential investors. The auditors came, big auditing firm called Main Herdman, no longer in existence. And they discovered very rapidly that WEDTECH had defrauded the Defense Department back in 1980 and had kept doing so to the tune of as much as $6 million. That was their first big crime, and they had done it to basically keep from going bankrupt. Well, they thought, the jig is up. We won't be able to have a public offering. They may expose us to the world. The company is going to fall apart in no time. But it turned out, and this is alleged, it has not yet been proved in court and may never be, it turned out that the chief auditor sent over by this firm said to them, well, wait a minute, I think we can solve this. And they reached, according to the WEDTECH officials, they reached an agreement. They would later hire this fellow for an enormous amount of money and a huge block of stock. And he, in turn, would explain the whole thing to his superiors back at the accounting firm in such a way that they would say, okay, here's the slap on the wrist, life can go on. And that's precisely what happened. So the point of that story is that WEDTECH was always learning from its environment. These fellows were clever learners. And they found that as long as you knew the method and as long as you knew the coin in which to pay people, you could always find a way of doing whatever you had to do to get ahead.
The example that you mentioned of defrauding the Defense Department of $6 million?
Yes.
What was that for?
Well, that was their first big crime. Back to 1980, still a small company. As always, there was a cash flow shortage. They desperately tried to find funds. They couldn't. Everything failed. It was late in 1980, and a fellow who was an accountant pointed out to one of the fellows who ran the company, a fellow named Mario Marino, that he had inadvertently, he said, submitted invoices to the Pentagon for work that they had not yet done. Nobody asked any questions. They had been quickly reimbursed. Well, this suggested a method to these fellows. Why don't they just start phonying up invoices and get paid for work before they do it? In effect, they wouldn't actually get ultimately more money, but they would increase their cash flow. They'd earn interest on the money before they had a right to get it. Well, they seriously debated this. It was their first obvious big fraud against the government. And it was a snowy day in December, and they argued back and forth, and a sense of despair hung over them all. And finally, they all said, it's this or we're going out of business. And I think other companies would have said, well, we obviously can't cheat the government. We've got to go out of business. These fellows said, if that's the choice, we'll cheat the government. And that was the beginning for them. And I think after that, the debates got much shorter.
James Traub is my guest, and he's written a new book about the WedTech scandal. Who did you speak to, protagonists in the WedTech story? Who was willing to talk to you?
Well, that was a big issue. I really wore myself out trying to get these people to talk to me. Some of them wanted to, and their lawyers wouldn't let me. Many of them just didn't want to. Of the guys who stood trial and got convicted, the only one who talked to me was John Mariotta. And John Mariotta was a very odd guy and very hard to talk to. I spent maybe 9 hours speaking with him. I sat in his house in Scarsdale. He had built himself a lovely ranch house with the proceeds from WedTech, from the stock, and from his theft. And it took about 9 hours for me to get from the time he was born until about 1980. We just kept going over his life story, and he would go off on long, rambling tales of his persecution because he was like a condemned man who could only relive the tale of persecution that he felt he had suffered. And when we finally got close to talking about the criminal acts, he suddenly turned against me. I said something wrong. I triggered something somehow, and I hit onto his paranoia. All of a sudden, he decided I was in league with all the people he thought were out to get him, the lawyers and the bankers and all the sophisticated people who he never understood. So he never answered my phone calls again and never let me talk to him. All of my entreaties went for naught. It was tremendously frustrating. Though I did get an awful lot out of him, of course, in those 9 hours. I also spoke at even greater length with a fellow named Tony Guerilla, who was also one of the inner circle. And he was the accountant genius, and an extraordinary genius he was, because WedTech did manage to fool or at least sufficiently disguise its unbelievably bad books by virtue of this fellow's ledger domain. Now, Guerilla did talk to me at great length. Basically, he gave me a lot of insight into how the company functioned in its latter years. And he's an unrepentant fellow, so he's good to talk to because he's not too much clouded by his conscience. He told me exactly what he did and what other people did. And people who don't have much of a conscience are often very good to talk to that way because they don't mind being straightforward about all their bad acts.
We kept trying to convince Mariotta that you weren't out to get him, but do you think you really were out to get him?
No. I feel that very strongly. I think anybody who reads my book will see that I'm not interested in making the kind of simplistic moral judgments that I think normally go into these sorts of things. I see all of these people as having complicated motives, at least most of them. And if something is complicated, it's more interesting to me than if it's simple and if it's obvious. Mariotta is not a simple person. I don't see him as being just a villain. Quite the contrary. I see him as being a person who is trapped by events. I see many of the people in this story as complicated people who had a strong element of idealism to them, as WedTech had a strong element of idealism to it as a company. My interest was really trying to understand what this fellow was all about and why he did what he did and what he told himself as he was doing it, what he believed about his own actions. And I think that was true of my feelings not only about Mariana, but about most of the others.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Journalist James Traub, his new book on WedTech is called Too Good to Be True. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, actor Peter Coyote. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jimi Hendrix is often thought of as the black guitarist who played psychedelic music for a largely white audience. Coming up, music journalist Charles Shar Murray reconsiders Hendrix's place in black culture. Also, fans of conductor and composer Pierre Boulez have reason to rejoice. There's a new 50 CD collection of Boulez's music in the works. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the first three offerings. And you've seen how Mark Frost and David Lynch have portrayed the Pacific Northwest in their series Twin Peaks. Coming up, TV critic David Bianculli reviews Frost's look at the entire country, the new series American Chronicles. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush told lawmakers today that if the international sanctions against Iraq fail, then the U.S. will review its options. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The president made the statement in a meeting with lawmakers who have just returned from the Persian Gulf. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater later offered no elaboration of the president's statement. Fitzwater said the president was gratified with the unanimous support he has received for his Persian Gulf policy. Fitzwater also said the president made a morale-boosting call to the U.S. Embassy in Kuwait, where water and electricity have been cut off by the Iraqis. The administration does not want to say how much longer the embassy staff will be expected to remain there under those conditions. As for the latest statements by Saddam Hussein, Fitzwater called them another rhetorical diatribe. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Iraqi President Saddam Hussein has called for a holy war against U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf and for the overthrow of King Fahd of Saudi Arabia. In a television message, Saddam said Iraqi children are dying because a U.N. embargo is keeping food, milk, and medicine from them. The Iraqi leader blamed the U.S. backed by Israel for the sanctions. British Foreign Secretary Douglas Hurd wound up a tour of the Gulf states today with a visit to Jordan. Hurd said that he was assured that Jordan shares the U.S. and British view that Iraq should withdraw from Kuwait unconditionally, but acknowledged that the Jordanians disagree on how that pullout should be brought about. NPR's Tom Gelton reports from Amman.
Douglas Hurd has been aggressive in his denunciation of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein, and in this country, where many sympathize with Saddam, Hurd's comments today got him in trouble. Dozens of Jordanian journalists walked out of Hurd's news conference here. The journalists deplored Britain's strategy, quote, to humiliate Arabs and keep them slaves. Hurd said that Saddam Hussein's offer to link Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait to Israel's withdrawal from the occupied territories was, quote, a smokescreen for aggression. But in response to the Jordanian journalists' walkout, Hurd said he regretted that the Iraqi invasion had diverted the world's attention from the Palestinian problem. This is one of Saddam's achievements, Hurd said. Hurd met with King Hussein, his brother, the Crown Prince Hassan, and Foreign Minister Marwan al-Qassem. The meetings, Hurd said, assured him that Jordan is bound by the United Nations sanctions against Iraq. I'm Tom Gelton in Amman.
President Bush will appear before a joint session of Congress next Tuesday night to report on developments in the Persian Gulf and the goals of the military buildup there. The speech will come 2 days after the president returns from his weekend summit with Soviet leader Gorbachev. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 15 points to close at 2,628.22 on volume of 120 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later in the show, TV critic David Bianculli reviews a new offbeat documentary series produced by the Twin Peaks team David Lynch and Mark Frost. But first, the Sony Classical label has just begun to release a series of 50 compact discs by the conductor and composer Pierre Boulez. Much of the material has been available on LP, but classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says Sony also has some new items.
I'd like to play you a passage from one of the most beautiful choral works in all of music. That was Friede auf Erden, Peace on Earth, and it was written in 1907 by a composer whose austere modernism is so intimidating you might not believe he was capable of anything so warm and openly emotional, Arnold Schoenberg. The BBC singers perform it with both deep feeling and soaring clarity under the inspired direction of Pierre Boulez. It's the opening selection on a two-disc set of Schoenberg's choral music, which includes a fascinating variety of work, from settings of German folk songs, psalms, and satires, to Schoenberg's daringly personal version of the Kol Nidre, the hymn of repentance sung on the Jewish High Holy Day, Yom Kippur. Schoenberg had become first a Catholic and then a Protestant convert. But when the Nazis forced him out of Germany just before World War II, he turned back to his original Judaism. The text, in English and Hebrew, is by Schoenberg himself. Boulez conducts tenor John Shirley Quirk and the BBC Orchestra and Chorus.
We repent of these obligations, have estranged us from the sacred task we were chosen.
The first five releases in Sony's ambitious Boulez edition emphasize music from the century we most associate with Boulez, the 20th. He conducts music from the so-called Second Viennese School, including momentous versions of Alban Berg's Lulu Suite and Lyric Suite, and music by French composers from Ravel down to Boulez's own kaleidoscopic compositions. One of his landmark recordings is an album devoted to the spacey, experimental, organized sound of Edgar Varèse. Here's some of the exhilarating and mysterious ionization in which 13 percussionists play 37 different percussion instruments. Boulez deserves his reputation for high-powered intellect, but his infinitely seductive performances of Ravel reveal another important side to his personality. The three-disc set of Ravel's orchestral works includes a devastating version of La Valse and a 1975 performance with the New York Philharmonic of the complete Daphnis and Chloe ballet. It has all the sinuous narrative flow and insinuating sexuality that's missing from Bernard Haitink's current best-selling disc with the Boston Symphony. The one new item in the Ravel set is probably the last piece in the world you'd associate with Boulez, the bolero. It's an odd yet irresistible performance. Here, the bolero is less a dance than a streamlined ghost train racing down a well-oiled but rather dangerously winding track. Thank you. There'll eventually be some 50 recordings in this Boulez edition. And with Sony's so-called high-definition sound and 20-bit technology, even the previously released performances sound fresh and new. Boulez has such an extraordinary ear. He brings to life so many nuances of a score that even a small improvement in sound lets us hear a lot more of what's already there.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. It's been 20 years since Jimi Hendrix's death, and British rock critic Charles Shar Murray thinks it's time to re-examine the Hendrix legend. Murray considers Hendrix the most eloquent instrumentalist ever to work in rock, but Murray says Hendrix has become a convenient focus for cozy generalizations about the innate phallocentricity of hard rock, the evils of drug use, and the reactionary tedium of the extended guitar solo. Murray is the author of the new book Crosstown Traffic, Jimi Hendrix and the Rock and Roll Revolution. Murray says the cliché is that Hendrix was a crazy black man who did funny things with a guitar, had thousands of women, and eventually died of drugs, which was a shame because he was a really good guitarist.
The first thing that I really wanted to do was to make as vociferous and articulate a protest as I possibly could about the surgical amputation of Hendrix from black culture, because sitting over here in England, it seemed to me sort of blindingly obvious that what Hendrix was doing was transmuting the music with which he'd grown up and combining it with the music that he was hearing around him. And after he died in the 70s, when black and white popular music suddenly stopped the stimulating conversation that they'd been having throughout the last half of the 50s and the 60s, it seemed to me as if the Hendrix problem, so to speak, had been resolved by trying to turn him into an honorary white. I kept meeting so many people whose record collections didn't include any black music except for Hendrix. And I just wanted to remake that connection. I mean, I thought the attitudes that a lot of rock people, and I emphasise rock people deliberately, had towards Hendrix was essentially racist. It was like an apartheid attitude.
Well, wasn't he seen as one of the few black performers playing psychedelic music, and psychedelic music was largely a white music?
Well, psychedelia was only one aspect of what Hendrix did. And to overemphasize that at the expense of his very real roots in soul, blues, and different sorts of jazz seemed rather short-sighted to me.
Do you think that Hendrix was perceived differently by white and black listeners?
That's a good question. I think he was, at least in the beginning, though I think that was beginning to change in the months before his death. I think some white listeners saw him as some kind of platonic ideal of, you know, the wild and crazy new age black man, and many black listeners probably thought that he was a musical clown who was pandering to misplaced white notions. And I think those attitudes were starting to change in the period just before his death, but because he died with so much of his work incomplete, those stereotypes were allowed to remain in place for far too long. I think attitudes to Hendrix now are changing. I think, for example, the work of Living Colour is causing many, many people to reassess the whole notion of black rock, which almost went onto the back burner when Hendrix died.
What do you think it was about Hendrix that made it easier for a lot of white listeners who didn't otherwise listen to black music to appreciate him?
Well, the fact that he came over from England, I mean, they found out later that he was, of course, a black American, and that he'd only been in England for 9 or 10 months. But he was re-exported to the US, dressed up to the back teeth in British fashion, with two British guys playing with him, operating in a style which was associated with the latest wave of British rock. It's a syndrome which has continued. I mean, Terence Trent D'Arby, for example, 20 years later, launched his career by going the Hendrix route. He came to Britain and re-exported himself as a British sensation. And many, many black American styles have proved unacceptable to white Americans until they've been to England. I mean, even Herbie Hancock didn't learn about hip-hop from Afrika Bambaataa or Grandmaster Flash. He heard it on a record by Malcolm McLaren.
That's an interesting observation.
So many things have to take... To get from Harlem to downtown in New York City, for example, they almost have to take a 6,000-mile round trip and go via London.
Are you suggesting that Americans, that white Americans are uncomfortable with African Americans, and that it's easier for them to relate to black people from other cultures?
Yes. Not entirely. I mean, let me qualify that by saying that this is not an absolute generalization, because I don't really believe there is any such thing as an absolute generalization. But, for example, so many white Americans didn't know about the blues in the 60s until they heard it from the Rolling Stones. And then they, inspired by the Stones, then they checked out the sources of that music and they discovered Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker and great artists like that. But all this wonderful music was, if not quite on their doorsteps, it was at least on the other side of the tracks all along. It had to go to England and come back first. I think, personally, I think it's a sad and disgraceful state of affairs, and I'm happy to say that this racial polarisation in popular music seems to be breaking down now with a vengeance, and I'm very happy to see that happening.
Do you think that Hendrix had a different meaning in London than he did in the States?
I think he did initially, because at the time that Hendrix arrived in Britain, all the hippoisie in London worshipped black American culture. Everybody had all the Muddy Waters records and all the more modern Stax and Motown and James Brown records. For the British scene, Hendrix was their own little piece of black America. And while he was anxious to gain their approval, they were equally anxious to gain his.
Jimi Hendrix got his start as a sideman in soul revues and rhythm and blues bands. How did he do in those bands? How was he as a sideman?
Everybody was impressed with his talent, but the world of the R&B revues of the early 60s demanded great discipline from musicians, both musical discipline and organizational discipline. And Hendrix was far too eager to experiment with his music, and far too willing not to fall in precisely with the demands of his leaders. He didn't keep too many jobs. They all admired his playing, but found him too hard to handle. He was probably fired by some of the greatest names in show business.
Well, you say even his clothes didn't fit in very well.
Yeah, there was one anecdote which Bobby Womack told me, and which was told to him by the late King Curtis. King Curtis would supply all his musicians with good, suits and ties and cufflinks. And Hendrix would show up with the double cuffs of his shirt just hanging loose over his hands, and his shirt tail out of his pants and his tie all loose. And Curtis would say, well, you know, put your cufflinks in, man. You know, this is why I got you that stuff. And Hendrix would just say, you know, I like it better this way. You know, he didn't fit in.
Do you see Hendrix as the father of the tedious and endless guitar solo, or the father of the kind of guitar solo where the guitar becomes an extension of the phallus?
I don't think Hendrix was the father of the phallic guitar solo, because if you can find old photographs of people like T-Bone Walker or Johnny Guitar Watson, a lot of that kind of very athletic, demonstrative guitar posing is a blues tradition that, you know, goes back to, you know, certainly before Hendrix discovered the electric guitar, and in some cases even before he was born. I think Hendrix inspired an awful lot of bad guitar solos, just as Bob Dylan, for example, inspired an awful lot of pretentious and meaningless songs.
Do you have a favorite of his guitar solos?
As you can imagine, I have several, but one of the most remarkable and also one of the least well-known is the alternate take of Machine Gun that appeared on the Ryko disc Jimi Hendrix Live and Unreleased set. There were two shows by the Band of Gypsies, both of which were recorded, and so obviously there's a performance of Machine Gun at each one. The take that was issued had a much better vocal, which is probably why Hendrix chose it, but the unissued take has one of the most extraordinary guitar solos ever played by Jimi Hendrix, or indeed anybody else. I'd say it's one of the most extraordinary things that any 20th century musician has done with a musical instrument.
Charles Shar Murray's book is Crosstown Traffic. Ryko Disc tells us that they actually have no plans to bring out this version of Machine Gun, but we thank them for loaning it to us. Fresh air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. From the Gulf, we have a story on refugee camps, all the workers that have come out of Kuwait and Iraq, and the international institutions that are attempting to move them back to their home countries. We also will be taking a look at the NEA and that whole controversy and whether or not it constitutes censorship not to give federal funds to some of these groups. And Alden Whitman, who some people have called the king of bad news, the obituary writer for the New York Times, who made his craft into an art, Alden Whitman himself has died.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Mark Frost, who co-created the series Twin Peaks with David Lynch, is starting up another series. This time it's on Fox, not ABC, and this time it's not a weird drama, it's a weird documentary series. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
Last season, thanks to Twin Peaks, David Lynch and partner Mark Frost were the talk of television. But Lynch, who had directed that pilot and was coming off a string of weirdo cult movies like Blue Velvet, was the guy almost everyone talked about. Frost, even though his credits included Hill Street Blues, was pretty much ignored. This week's new Fox series, American Chronicles, is an attempt to even those scales a bit. It's a Lynch-Frost production, but it's definitely Mark Frost's baby. The series is his idea, he wrote and directed the pilot, and he seems determined to prove that he can be just as strange as David Lynch when it comes to making TV shows. American Chronicles is designed as a weekly half-hour look at American places, people, and events. And look is the key word, because the show is intensely visual. The pilot episode is all about New Orleans at Mardi Gras time. And much of it, including the show's first 2 minutes, is presented without words. What narration there is later is provided by Richard Dreyfuss, who delivers his comments in a detached, almost comic style.
New Orleans. We're in New Orleans. New Orleans is a deep water port on the banks of the Mississippi River in southern Louisiana. An isolated banana republic somewhere north of the south and south of the north. The party capital of the Western world. Famous for its obsessive pursuit of the perfect meal. Its single-minded devotion to earthy, sensual delights. But most of all, for its Mardi Gras.
The images in American Chronicles are unusual, to say the least. So is Frost's script, which devotes itself to putting the Mardi Gras celebration in a rather dark historical context. But from the co-creator of Twin Peaks, what did you expect? Sweetness and light?
What is Mardi Gras? Pagan celebrations in the pre-Christian world were characterized by rampant intoxication, rape, flagellation, bloodshed and animal sacrifice, a debauched descent into man's animalistic nature. The church, distressed by these excesses, eventually corralled them into the Catholic calendar as the carnival season. Carnival, from the Latin carnevale, farewell to the flesh.
This first episode of American Chronicles is kind of like what would happen if you gave Charles Kuralt's on-the-road job to gonzo journalist Hunter S. Thompson and assigned Federico Fellini as cameraman. It's different, and it's kind of fascinating. But my question is whether American Chronicles can sustain its powerful imagery when its subjects are less visually arresting than Mardi Gras. We'll have to wait and see. With C, like I said, being the key word.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers produced the interviews on Fresh Air with research assistance from Dan Buskirk and Lisa McCullough. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Peter Coyote, on going from cultural radical to movie actor. In the 60s, he performed street theater with the San Francisco Mime Troupe and ran a free store with the Diggers. Now he's best known for his roles in E.T. and Jagged Edge. Also, a talk with jazz drummer Tony Williams. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.